Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Happy Friday. Today we've got Dr. Lena Wen coming up in our B segment, about a half hour, who says, stop calling them vaccine passports. We've got our Friday Ask the Mayor call in. Why is kindergarten enrollment for next fall down by 12% and much more? With my questions and yours for Bill de Blasio. Gia Tolentino from The New Yorker today on why she quit Twitter, and your calls with Gia on your relationship with social media during the pandemic. So many people have had so many changes with their relationship with social media, whether quitting it, becoming more dependent, it becoming more fraught, lots of things, and we will take your calls on that. But we start here. On the day of yet another mass shooting in America, President Biden is trying something new, executive action to get around a gridlock Congress to the extent that the Constitution might allow. Yesterday's mass shooting was in Bryan, Texas. The one in South Carolina this week was by a former player on the New York Jets, whose family says football messed up his brain. We're all still reeling from Atlanta and Boulder, too, of course. And if you've been following the news closely, you might also be aware of just how deadly the whole past year has been with respect to gun violence. According to data from the Gun Violence Archive, 2020 saw the number of shootings with four or more victims increase more than 50%. So yesterday, President Biden announced a slate of executive actions aimed at curbing gun violence. Among them is one that publishes a model for red flag laws. Those are laws that allow family members and law enforcement to petition for a temporary court order to keep people in crisis or potential crisis from accessing firearms. Another action instructs the Justice Department to issue an annual report on firearms trafficking, something, believe it or not, it hasn't done in over 20 years.
Gun violence in this country is an epidemic. Let me say it again. Gun violence in this country is an epidemic, and it's an international embarrassment.
But can things like these executive orders make any real difference while respecting gun rights, or are they just a sideshow to the demoralizing cycle we begin to become accustomed to, where high-profile mass shootings lead to talk for a few weeks, political momentum then sputters, and the media moves on to the next tragedy, at least until the next staggering act of gun violence? Time will tell. Joining me now is Champ Barton, reporter at The Trace, a nonprofit news site covering gun violence. Hi, Champ. Thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And let me start at what would seem like something obvious from Biden's executive actions, compiling the data on gun trafficking. Some people listening might be surprised to hear that the Justice Department has not released any comprehensive study of gun trafficking patterns since the year 2000. It's not implausible to assume that these patterns have changed over 21 years. Why has it been so long?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. And I unfortunately don't think there is really a clear answer to that. I mean, you're certainly right. These patterns almost undoubtedly have changed. The sort of gun marketplace has moved online in a lot of ways, which dramatically affects the way that guns are bought and sold and, you know, trafficked. There are some like theories as to why a report might not have been published since then. I mean, the report in 2000 relied at least partially on firearms tracing data, which is sort of the central data set that would be used to find gun traffickers in the U.S. And in 2003, there was an amendment passed by Congress called it's colloquially known as the Tehart Amendment, which restricted some of the ability of the ATF to publish this data. And it wouldn't be surprising to me if some of the ATF were just a little bit hesitant to skirt too close to that line that prevents them from publicizing that data. But another really important thing to note is just that the ATF has been like woefully understaffed for a very long time and underfunded. In 2019, they employed only about 770 investigative staff, to conduct compliance inspections of like almost 80,000 licensed gun dealers. And it's entirely possible that they're just like sort of swamped and that it's difficult to compile, you know, one of these investigative reports. The report that you're referring to in 2000 was actually the product or was built upon some reports that were requested by Congress. And Congress hasn't requested another one of these reports, like you said, until Biden did so yesterday.
And listeners, let me open up the phones on a few aspects of this. First, I wonder if there's anybody listening in law enforcement or previously in law enforcement or anybody who has engaged in gun trafficking yourself from out of state or out of our area. You don't have to give your real identity and it doesn't have to be ongoing at the moment, who can say, how do guns that would not legally be sold in New York or New Jersey or Connecticut get to our area? What should we know about gun trafficking patterns that perhaps your experience in law enforcement or in the underworld or anywhere else might help reveal to our listeners? 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280. We'll also get into red flag laws, another topic from the president's executive orders. Anybody grapple with this ever? Like the fraught question of whether to report a loved one who might own a gun or have an interest in owning a gun to authorities because you think they are too unstable or too dangerous in any way to own a gun? Has anybody ever been through that with a loved one, maybe with a client? If you're a therapist, are you even allowed to do that? Does that break confidentiality, or do you have a duty to report in a circumstance like that? Or anyone else on red flag laws and gun trafficking patterns, two of the prime topics from President Biden's gun-related executive orders yesterday, 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280, with Champ Barton, reporter at The Trace, which, if you don't know, is a really excellent nonprofit news site covering gun violence. Champ, can you elaborate on the one-sentence description of red flag laws that I gave just before I introduced you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so red flag laws, the first red flag law was established in 1999 in Connecticut, but in the years since, they've most frequently been enacted as a response to mass shootings. Interestingly, though, they are actually sort of more, quote unquote, effective as a suicide prevention tool. The way they work is that they allow certain individuals who have some relationship to someone who may be at some risk of hurting themselves or others. In some states, this is just law enforcement officials. In others, it can be family members or medical health professionals or school officials. But essentially, it allows these people to petition a court to remove the firearms from a person who may be a risk to themselves or others. In New York City, police officers, school administrators, district attorneys, family members, or household members can request these sorts of hearings. And the way that the process works is that the person making the request will have a hearing with a judge where the person whose firearms will be restricted is not present. And so let's say the school official, for example, will present evidence saying, you know, I think this person is a risk. If the judge agrees, they will grant the order temporarily. The guns will be removed from the person who is at risk. And then within like a week or so, that person will have an opportunity to present their own evidence as to why they should be able to keep their guns. And then the judge will make a determination about the length of the order, essentially. And if the evidence that the person whose guns were taken away is compelling, then they may grant them access to their guns again. If not, they might say, like, you know, for a year, you will not have access to your guns and you cannot buy any new guns.
And President Biden is not mandating a national red flag law. It seems to me all he's doing, and this is why it's possible that he's prohibited from doing anything that has much of an impact with respect to guns, just nibbling around the edges. All he's ordering the Justice Department to do, as I understand it, is print up guidelines that states could use if they don't already have red flag laws like New York and Connecticut do, to write ones of their own. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah, it's just model legislation so that they have some sort of, you know, blueprint to follow if a state who doesn't have one of these laws wants to implement one.
Do you have any sense of, let's say in the case of New York, where the red flag law took effect statewide only in 2019, or in Connecticut, which has had it for 20 more years, who actually tends to have their gun rights restricted under these laws?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. There isn't like great data on this, but typically, like I said, I mean, these have been proven in some studies to be pretty effective suicide prevention tools. I was reading something earlier. There was a study in 2018 led by a team of psychiatrists at Duke, and they were examining the efficacy of Connecticut's red flag law. And their team estimated that for every 10 to 20 gun seizures, one suicide was prevented. So that doesn't really give you too much of a specific sense of the individuals whose guns are being taken away, but it does kind of give you a sense for what is being prevented, which I think is what's, you know, most important here. And in that instance, it is for the most part suicide.
Let's take a phone call. Here's Rick in White Plains. You're on WNYC. Rick, thanks so much for calling in.
Hey, my pleasure. So I've sat in on probably half a dozen ERPOs, which is what we call emergency risk protection orders. Mm-hmm. And generally what they're being applied to are people who are floridly mentally ill and their family members know they have firearms, or for people who have, for instance, early onset dementia, they're wandering in the street, they drop a gun and they forget that it's there, or they're sitting on their front porch with a shotgun aiming it at family members. and they do work for that. And this is, and the other thing I wanted to say is, having worked in law enforcement for more than 30 years, guns get driven in cars from states where they're easier to buy. They get driven to Webster Avenue or some other place in the city of New York where there are currently no police patrols, because most of the police patrols are around Central Park where the tourists are. And people take them out of the trunks of their cars and they sell them. It's that simple. The cops aren't where the guns are coming in, because those are underserved communities, and a lot of times they don't want the police there. So they tell the police to get out, and that's when the guns get transported in, there's no cops. The feds have much more involvement in gun trafficking. There aren't a lot of feds. There are so many crimes going on that you can't really get below the most intense level of crime in any area. So, I mean, there are a lot of things that are not, they don't fit into the left-right narrative. And more importantly, you can't have, I mean, both sides are lying. You can have no gun violence only if you have no firearms. But you can't have a society where you have firearms, whether they're legal or not, whether they're protected or not, and have no gun violence. Eventually, somebody's going to flip out who passed a background check and commit violent acts. That's going to happen.
Right. But the question is degree and compared to other countries. I have the stats somewhere. I could look them up. But I imagine, Rick, that working in law enforcement, you know these roughly. We have so many more guns per capita than any other country in the world, not even close. And we have so many more gun deaths per capita than any other country in the world. And so it's a question of degree, right? It's not like we can get it to zero, or anybody can get it to zero, but what's going on in this country is unique.
That's true. And however, I just wanted to state, you're not finding NRA members going out committing gun crimes. These are people that the NRA wouldn't want in their membership. And every time a new gun control law is proposed, it doesn't. For instance, the best gun control action we ever had was James Comey back during the Bush administration locking up people in federal prison for gun crimes. That's not happening today. They're being let go on plea bargains. We have people walking around who are in violation of New York State's weapons laws, and they're out on probation. So if you're not going to lock people up with a history of burglary and assault who got caught with an illegal handgun, how is cracking down on some guy who has a rifle and wants to shoot gophers out on his ranch? How is that going to have an effect? It's not. So there's, when it comes to locking up dangerous sociopaths, that's
Rick. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call and your perspective. There's one thing I just have to jump in and not let go unaddressed. When he said that there aren't police on Webster Avenue. He's talking about Webster Avenue in the Bronx, and they're all around Central Park to protect the tourists. We know that the history of the last 30 years, and really much, much longer, is that people in the black and brown communities that he's referring to by implication there feel way over-policed, and that police saturate their neighborhoods. So I couldn't let that go unaddressed. Champ, is there anything that you want to say to anything that, I mean, he was making a gun rights case. He can do that. He's also got, you know, perspective, it seems, from his background on both trafficking and red flag laws.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you made a good point there, and that was one I was going to bring up. But the other thing is, at the end of his point there, he sort of mentioned, you know, you're not targeting these quote-unquote dangerous sociopaths with these, you know, more run-of-the-mill gun control laws. And I think there's two points to make about that argument. One is, you know, on a certain level, if you sort of back away from his language, that is sort of correct in some way. A thing like a red flag law isn't necessarily designed to stop gun homicides in that are sort of routine in many cities across the country. Because these people are not necessarily people who are, you know, having mental health breakdowns. These are sort of more crimes of survival. But the thing that is important to note, and I think, you know, this is another facet, I think probably the most important facet of Biden's gun control plan at present, is that the idea that you have to lock these people up in order to contain gun crime is sort of misguided. I think that there are an abundance of community gun violence intervention programs out there that are sort of underfunded and struggling to get sort of state or city backing. In Biden's gun control plan, he announced like $5 billion to try to go to some of these programs. And there is a lot of evidence to suggest that that sort of effort will be way more effective than, mass incarceration at reducing gun crime in the U.S.
And some of the numbers, to put a little more meat on the bones of what I hinted at a minute ago, and I cited these a couple of times on the show recently after Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times put some very clear data graphics in his column. Guns per 100 people in the United States, 120 guns per 100 people in the United States. The next closest, Canada, 34 guns per 100 people, 34 compared to 120. And gun murders per 100,000 people, the United States, 3.4 murders per 100,000 people with guns. Canada is again the next closest with 0.6, a rate of 0.6 compared to 3.4 in the United States. That's more than five times the rate. So, Champ, just to put that fine point on it again before we go any further, this is the third time in recent weeks on this show, but the U.S. is really in a class by itself.
Absolutely. I mean, the interesting thing about that is that you have there is so much research to suggest that, an increase in the number of guns that are in circulation increases the number of gun crimes that happen, gun homicides, gun suicides, shootings, et cetera. And that's to be expected. I mean, it's sort of like what the listener was just saying, which is basically like if you have no guns, then no one can shoot anybody with a gun because there's no guns to shoot. That is absolutely, you know, the proliferation of guns in the U.S. absolutely correlates with the, you know, amount of gun death that we see in this country.
Do you know, by the way, to the one of the caller's other points, because he was taking aim at some of the bail reform and parole and other criminal justice reforms, if people convicted of gun crimes or accused of gun crimes, maybe it's possession and not actually using the weapon, but whatever, are being let out of jail or let out of prison more frequently than before?
I don't actually know the figures on that. But I do think it's important to note, before moving on here, like the assumption that we have going into sort of an examination like that is that these people are prone to crime. And so if you let them out, there's a chance that someone who is prone to crime because they have done crime, committed some sort of gun crime in the past, will do so again. But what we sort of omit in any of that conversation often is why these people are committing crimes. And if you sort of think of them like humans, then you'll understand very quickly that the reason that someone is committing crime is because of, you know, very understandable problems that they are experiencing, whether it be food insecurity, housing insecurity, income insecurity. There are a number of community problems that correlate very heavily with, you know, high rates of gun violence in cities across the country. And there are many activists and many researchers who have been pointing to this for decades now. And I think, you know, the important, you know, going back to Biden's executive action plan, like this $5 billion that he announced for community gun violence intervention programs is really like one of the first times that the government has ever taken note of that correlation between, you know, these like socioeconomic problems and gun crime, and try, you know, essentially given it a shot and tried to address those rather than addressing sort of this problem from a law enforcement perspective.
And so those are like the community-based violence interrupter groups.
Exactly.
Is that what's getting funding?
Yes, there's a number of different programs, and it's not 100% clear the exact type of programs that are going to get this money. But yes, I mean, those violence interrupter programs will almost certainly be among the group that does.
Here is Daniel, a professor at West Point. He says, Daniel, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Hey, good morning, Brian. My comment has to do with a lot of the arguments that I hear about good guys with guns can fix these problems, and that more guns in the hands of good people can fix things. And I want to just share a personal story. I was about 23 years old in Texas, and I believe that, you know, having a gun is a good right to have, and that we should exercise it, and good people should carry guns. And I carried a handgun for about a year. And what I found was that the more I carried the gun, the more my spidey sense was up, and that I was looking for situations where I might be able to make a positive difference. But the more I thought about that, the difficulty it is for a good person to, you know, engage and utilize a firearm in a stressful situation is so incredibly high that I came to the conclusion that it's probably best that I don't carry it, that I'm not going to be a positive factor in fixing any of these problems. And I think that something that gets missed in these arguments is that the skill necessary to be able to engage and use a firearm in a stressful situation is a really, really hard thing. And that the factors that we need to have in place for people that want to do that, the standards need to be much higher for the general population if they indeed want to be a card-carrying firearm owner. And I just don't think that the standards are high enough.
I wonder if you were thinking about this argument at all in the Boulder shooting, or after we heard what happened in the Boulder shooting, when there was that hero cop who, because of a sense of duty, doing what he was trained to do, charged in there rather than away from it to be the good guy with a gun, but not a bystander, not a civilian. He was a police officer who ran into the shooting in the middle of the shooting, and he did disable the shooter from being able to continue his rampage, but he got killed by the shooter in the process.
You know, and in that situation, he was an off-duty police officer. I think that he's in a position to maybe make a difference. The thing I'm thinking about is, like, in an active shooter situation where there's multiple people with guns, how is it that a police officer is supposed to know the difference? And on top of that, if I'm always looking for an opportunity to use my gun, given the state of the world that we're in, that's just not a good position. I just don't think that the argument that good people with guns can always make a good difference is a strong one.
Daniel, thank you very much. And I was backing up your point, saying even in a case where it's trained law enforcement, like the officer in Boulder, you know, he may not come out of it alive, though he did make a difference in that case. Champ, is there data on this? Because I could get, you know, pro-gun rights people versus pro-gun safety law enhancement people to argue all day whether it's more dangerous for people, quote unquote, good people, to be armed, for in the event of an active shooter situation that they may come upon or be in the middle of, versus the harm that would be done through the proliferation of guns because there'll be more suicides and whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that last point is the one to make. I think, like, there is absolutely an abundance of data that suggests that the sort of increase in gun ownership leads to, or at least correlates with, an increase in gun crimes. The issue with trying to examine whether the good guy with a gun logic works is because what you're dealing with really are just like edge cases here. There are so few mass shootings, so little of the gun deaths, so few of the gun deaths, or gun homicides at least, in the U.S. every year result from somebody being in sort of a public place and, you know, there's a classic sort of like movie criminal drawing a weapon and then being either, you know, disarmed by another person with a weapon or not. I mean, the vast majority of gun homicides in the U.S. happen in cities, like I was mentioning before, in places where there are just like an abundance of socioeconomic problems that lead to this sort of criminal behavior. And I think that the good guy with a gun versus bad guy with a gun binary argument thing that goes on often in political circles sort of obscures the fact.
Whoops, did we lose Champ? Champ Barton from The Trace, I guess his line dropped off. We'll go to our next caller in the meantime while we reconnect him. Carol in Clinton Hill, yes. You're on WNYC. Hi, Carol. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, good morning. Good morning. Yeah, I was just, given what the first guy, was talking about, how they would arrest the person, and then as they get out of jail, they give them back the gun. I don't agree with that, because where I live out, there's a lot of gun violence. And it was 1 year, it was clean, no shooting, and now it's just where, everybody's just shooting at each other.
Do you have...
We had two deaths.
Yes, go ahead, I'm sorry.
We had two deaths within 1 month, And then we had an innocent bystander where she was coming up this particular store, and she ended up getting shot. But the other two were shooting at each other.
It's terrible. Carol, do you have an impression why it's spiking in your neighborhood in the last year?
I think it's because everybody's probably on edge right now because of the COVID-19, I believe. And I'm just, very shocked, people getting killed. We had two people killed in 1 month.
Is there any particular either police response or other policy response that you would like to see?
I'd like to give a heads up to the 76 precincts, which they have very, very, very good record of showing up and helping the public.
Carol, thank you for your call. And that obviously is terrible what's going on in your neighborhood. And we know that there's been a significant increase in shootings around New York City and around the country in the last year. And Champ Barton from The Trace is back on the line with us. Champ, I don't know if you heard the last caller from Clinton Hill, Brooklyn, talking about how there hadn't been many shootings in her neighborhood in recent years, and they have spiked in the last year. Do you at The Trace have data or research or reporting that indicates, for all the competing theories out there, and people will say the police are pulling back in light of the racial justice movement, or they'll say, like Carol was indicating, people are more on edge during the pandemic, or there could be other reasons that people bring up. Do you have good reporting on this? Like, what is causing this spike in shootings the last year?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm glad you asked this question because this comes up all the time. And I think, I'm kind of beating a dead horse here, but if you think about what happened last year, is you have a pandemic that took a lot of people out of their jobs and therefore and put a lot of people, ended with a lot of people's lives and essentially put a lot of neighborhoods and communities into sort of a worsened socioeconomic climates. It's exacerbating the same problems, what we would consider the root causes of gun violence that are already, that already on a regular day are causing shootings. And now you have this sort of added pressure of the pandemic, which has worsened your, access to food, your access to your, income, your access to housing, whatever it might be. There is not a robust research just because, the pandemic is still going on and it's really hard to do this stuff on the fly. But The researchers that I've spoke with about this, and the activists and the advocates and the community members who are dealing with this that I've spoke with in my reporting, seem to be in sort of overwhelming agreement that the last year has just really exacerbated the root causes of gun violence. And so you're just seeing an increase that is sort of proportional to the amount that the pandemic has worsened these socioeconomic prospects for communities across the country.
Before we run out of time, I want to touch one other thing that was in the president's executive actions yesterday. He addressed what are known as ghost guns. Explain what that is. Is that like literally homemade guns out of a 3D printer or something?
Correct. Yeah, it's not always made out of a 3D printer, but yes, it essentially just refers to guns that are not serialized. And the way that these are made is that guns...
When you say serialized, you mean they don't have a serial number on them, right?
Correct. And the way that these guns are made typically is that there is like a single regulated component of the gun, essentially, that needs to have a serial number. And it's called an 80% lower receiver. It's not worth to really get into the details of what that means, really. But essentially, it's just this like chassis of the gun. And if this component can be made in a 3D printer, and you know, other there are like gun kits that allow you to construct it from a variety of smaller parts. And essentially, if you don't have this 80% lower receiver from a factory, essentially, then you won't have any sort of serialized component on the gun, and the gun therefore will have no serial number, and that's what's considered a ghost gun.
Well, there isn't that much that the president can do without going through the gridlock Congress on this, but he's trying to do what he can. That his advisors tell him the Constitution and the law allow him to do by executive action. So he did a few things yesterday. We've been talking about them with Champ Burton, who's a reporter for The Trace, a nonprofit news site covering gun violence. Champ, thanks for your time this morning. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Brian.